Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another new, exciting, Positively Autistic Radio Show with Sarah and Joe this evening. And we have a very special guest here with us this evening. We have Anita Lesko, a registered nurse, and so happy to have her on board our show this evening. So good evening, Anita.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. So, Anita, we've got a set of questions, as you know, so we'll kick off.
Absolutely lovely, Sarah, and I'm really looking forward to the show as well this evening, because we did speak to Anita Bakalong. I think it must have been, at least over a year ago now. So it's great to have Anita back and talk about some of the things that have happened since then, because there have been some great things. And I'd like to welcome you on the show as well, Anita.
Thank you.
And I was going to start by talking about a few things that I noted down and a few things that I know about Anita that I thought would be a good opening to the show. So Anita sent me some wonderful articles that she's written online about some of the things that she has done and some of the things she's experienced as an individual on the autism spectrum. And one of the areas that to me is prominent, and Anita highlights that, is employment and, you know, mechanisms and the journey that Anita has been on as an individual on the autism spectrum and how that has helped her to get to the career that she's in now. So I just wanted to say that some of the things highlighted on there were about the work and the close relationship that Anita has with Dr. Temple Grandin. And as we know, Dr. Temple Grandin is a huge, wonderful, inspirational lady in the autism community. And we've had Temple Grandin on one of our shows previously, which is great. And Temple Grandin has some really powerful messages. And I know has traveled the world. I know she doesn't quite so much now, but she really has done some wonderful things. So that's very interesting as well. And I was reading about kind of the starting journey that Anita was talking about, and how when Anita was young, she would often do jobs that were even something people may consider to be small jobs or, you know, activities. But the point is that those jobs still nurture vital skills, like even just getting children to work in the house and do chores. They have responsibilities, so it's nurturing those skills, especially if they are autistic, to help them, you know, gear towards employment later on in life. And Anita was saying how she started off by mucking out horse stalls, which is something that both Anita and Temple Grandin have in common, as well. And both also, as we know, Dr. Temple Grandin also is very into agriculture and working with animals, and that's another thing Anita was talking about, you know, the love for horses and how that was a kind of therapy for both Temple Grandin and Anita, which we're going to talk about and ask Anita later on in the show. But some really interesting statistics that I was reading on Anita's articles of the statistics in the US, America, because of course they do fluctuate all the time, of course, and they are different per country. And I was reading that 85% of autistic people are unemployed, and of course 15% are gainfully employed. So, you know, it's a high statistic of people that are not employed. So we're going to be kind of, you know, talking about the reasons for that and how Anita believes we can, you know, help people get into employment. So that's going to be really, really important. And of course, 3.5 million Americans said to be on the autism spectrum, and one in 68 of those children. I know here in the UK, it's said to be approximately every one in 100 children is on the spectrum. But of course, we're a much, much smaller country. So that explains, you know, those figures. So I'm really looking forward to talking to you today, Anita, and I know we've got lots of exciting things, including also talking about your wedding and celebrating your first wedding anniversary and the wonderful All Autism event that you held open to the public when you got married. So really looking forward to it, and thank you very much for taking the time to join us today on the radio show.
My pleasure, Joe.
Thank you. So, Sarah, would you like to start with the first question that we have for Anita?
Yeah. Please, could you tell us about the work you do in the autism community?
Yes. Well, when I got diagnosed with autism at the age of 50, which that's a class, you know, a late in life diagnosis. I mean, I went the first 50 years of my life not knowing why I never fit in and why I was so different. It was quite a struggle all those years until I found out only by chance one day while at work when a coworker's son had gotten diagnosed and she was talking about it. That was the night that I discovered that that's the key to the reasons of all of my life mysteries, so to speak. After I got diagnosed, I've embarked, that was 7 years ago, I embarked on a mission to become a very strong autism advocate. So I've written a number of books. I have a book that I'm very excited that's coming out in September from the Future Horizons, which is a leading autism publisher. That particular book is going to be about, it's geared towards healthcare workers and how to successfully provide care for autistic patients. I combined my 28 years in the medical profession as a certified registered nurse anesthetist and being autistic, combined those two things together to write this book that I hope and plan on, I envision it to change the whole world, not just in America, but for around the whole world, so that autistic people can get excellent health care just like everybody else. Autistic patients need to be, dealt with in a little bit of a different manner than other patients. And just for our differences, so I'm going to enable the healthcare workers to know how to deal with autistic patients. So that's one of the things I do. I write articles constantly for various magazines that get published, speak on any kind of radio shows or talk shows or anything that I can do, or speak at autism conferences to share all my life's wisdom with autistic individuals and for their parents, employers, and anyone who wants to increase their awareness and knowledge about autistic individuals and how to interact with them.
That is excellent, and that is so important as well, because of course being able to actually work with and approach those on the spectrum is very, very important, and it's something I know Sarah is very passionate about as well, training up other professionals that may not know about autism, because although you may hear the word professional, you're not sure exactly, you know, what it entails and what autism entails. So perhaps, Sarah, before we move on to the next question, you'd like to talk about the work you do in terms of training people.
Yeah, in 2012, myself and a colleague, we were approached by Humberside Fire and Rescue Service on both sides of the River Humber. They approached us around having some free autism awareness training from us, because obviously them going out as fire crews and community safety advocates, they had no idea how to engage with those on the autistic spectrum. So we gave them some free autism awareness training sessions, and we won an award in 2012 for it, because they said it was the best training that they could have ever have had from us, and how vitally important it is to get that same training out there to other emergency service crews and other emergency services. And now they can take it out into the field of their everyday jobs as fire crews and community safety advocates, knowing how to appropriately and professionally engage with those on the autistic spectrum. And to win an award is the best feeling of my life ever, and I'll never forget it.
That's, yes, I can well imagine, yes.
That's brilliant, Sarah, thank you. So a question I have for you, Anita, which I find really interesting to find out, especially for our listeners, is so in your profession as a certified registered nurse anaesthetist, could you tell us a little bit maybe about what it's actually like to work in the operating room? Because I'm aware that there's many, many other colleagues and team members that you have to communicate with. And I know that something for individuals with autism, social interaction can be a struggle. So I know this kind of job is very, very demanding. So it'd be lovely to hear from you about the profession and how you kind of got to there and learning curves.
Yes. Well, I graduated from Columbia University in 1988, and then I took my board exam and then passed that, and then I've been working full-time ever since now. So that's 28 years now as a nurse anesthetist. And yes, it is a very demanding job. It's a high-stress job because I have patients' lives in my hands every day. It's high-stress for me, especially because I have to also interact with many, many people every day. And very recently, I actually calculated out, knowing how many people per day that I interact with, and multiplied it over weeks, months, years, and I came out to that I've interacted over 1 million times with people on my job for all these years that I've been doing it. Now, many years ago, it was much more difficult for me to interact with people, but as the more I did it, the better I got at it. And now it's kind of funny because people will say, when I tell them I'm autistic, they'll say, "Oh my gosh, I would have never guessed you're autistic." And I say, "Well, I was 20 years ago. I wasn't like this, but it's just a repetition of interacting over and over and over again. And the more you do it, the better you get at it." It's kind of funny because the actual act of doing anesthesia on people, I've done it so many times. I've done over 50,000 cases already in my career. That's not the difficult part. The difficult part is the interacting with people and also being able to withstand all the massive sensory overload that I encounter every day on my job. Now, that includes things like when you're in the operating room, there's bright lights that are overhead the operating table. There is typically about 10 people in the operating room, and most of all of which are talking all the time. So I've got the input of 10 people's conversations going on. Most surgeons like music playing in the operating room, and unfortunately it's often things like heavy metal played very loud. So I've got that going on. Then I have about 4 different monitors that are beeping and making various sounds that I have to keep track of, and all of that. And sometimes the operating room has to be kept very warm, like 78 or 80 degrees for certain types of surgery. So I have basically every kind of sensory system being massively overloaded. Over the years, I've learned to be able to tolerate it, but what it does is it exhausts me. By the end of the day, I am so exhausted. Basically, it's come home, and Abraham, his job is stressful to him as well, what he does. So by the time both of us get home, we're ready to just have a quick dinner and go to sleep and try and get at least 7, if not 8 hours of sleep before the next day to be able to withstand it all over again. So that's what my life is like working in the operating room, in which I do 5 days a week.
Wow, that's incredible, Anita. So I was talking just before we started the questions about previous things that you've done, so as well as the experiences and the years of practice that you've had. Do you think there are any other influences earlier on in your life in terms of the responsibility element that has helped you in all of the responsibilities you have in general? So kind of aside from the operating room, any of the other administrative things that you have to do, and maybe the social interaction side of it. Do you think that, so any parents listening for children or teenagers, do you believe that even though it may seem trivial, even just doing small jobs that have minimal responsibilities still are a huge help in terms of, you know, maybe being age 12 or 15 to them being in their 20s and actually holding down a full-time job? So having those skills, you know, to nurture that, I think you would agree is important to actually get them into jobs where they can handle responsibilities.
in that article you made reference to earlier about, I think it's how childhood jobs prepared me for success as an autistic adult. That particular article where I talk about the extreme importance for parents to recognize the fact that when they have a child who's on the autism spectrum, they need to get that child very young doing any kind of small jobs in the house so that they give them like little assignments to do so the child has some kind of responsibility, no matter how small, as you said, or trivial the job may seem. But it is a responsibility for the child to keep a track of doing that and progress the level of complexity as the child gets older, once they're in their teens. And another thing is, I'll get to that in a second, actually, about volunteer work. But, you know, when they're in their mid-teens or whatever, a child is able to get a job at, let's say, a hamburger chain, a McDonald's, or in some kind of place like that, where they only work maybe a few hours a week, but it enables the child to go to a job environment and have to interact with other employees and a boss giving them orders of what to do and everything. If there's no opportunities like that where a person lives, there's also volunteer work, which can be either a local hospital, various things that if a parent looks into, they can find a job for their child to do maybe on a weekend for a few hours here and there or something, or if there's elderly neighbors in the neighborhood where the teenage child can go there maybe initially with the parent to be sure it's safe, of course, all the time. Everything revolves around safety first, but for a child to maybe assist the elderly people, maybe do some lawn work or do some laundry or cleaning for them, or just do something, anything, as long as it's some kind of a job that requires taking, you know, following orders, taking responsibility, and having to be responsible for what they do. That building upon that, that's the basic building blocks, because it enables the person to interact with other people, follow orders, and all that kind of thing. As a person gets older and they build upon all that, they're going to be ready to go out into the work world after they complete their schooling or training or whatever it is that they're going to do, because you can't take somebody that's been sheltered at home until they're, you know, 23 years old or something, and then think that that person can go into a work environment and work. When you're autistic, you need every possible social interaction that you can get prior to going out into the work world and being able to function on a job. Now, I know that if I didn't do all those things when I was younger to build up my interaction skills and work ethics and all that, I would have never been able to graduate from school and suddenly go out into a work environment and have to contend with, you know, 50 people every day in a job environment. There would just be no way an autistic person can transition into that type of, even if a person wasn't autistic, it would be extremely difficult, but all the more so when they're autistic. You know, parents have to get those kids working, get them doing something, whatever it is, starting around in the house, you know, whether it's teaching a child how to do laundry, teach them how to vacuum, teach them how to dust the furniture, help set the kitchen, help set the dining table, help the mother cook at mealtime, do whatever it takes to get that kid doing something. And, of course, maintaining their schoolwork, of course, that's also a priority. And keeping them off of computers is another big thing. I know my friend Temple Grand, and she's on a rant about that now, about keeping the kids off the computers, because if you let your child sit in front of a computer for 4 or 5 hours a night playing video games and doing whatever, how is that going to help them with their future? It isn't. So keep them off of that machine and keep them in real life, kind of like in the good old days when there was no computers. Just get them involved, get them into things, and that's going to build the strong foundation for their future.
Yes, definitely. That's a very good point, Anita. And there are some kind of popping up more prevalent actually in the last 6 months or so, various organizations for employment for individuals with autism that work to develop skills and things like learning, you know, basic skills for programming, or even just helping an individual set up an email address. Because I've read some articles recently that, you know, some individuals haven't even been shown how to have email addresses. And one of the points are that to apply for jobs and do things like that, you need an email address. So learning how to compose emails, things like that, how you would prepare for an interview. Of course, preparing for an interview is a very big thing. Practicing and knowing what it's actually like. So I suppose that can be quite a daunting process to go through the formal stages of going to be, you know, applying to a job and then actually having to go to the interview. So yeah, definitely some very important points made there. So in terms of your profession that we were talking about on the previous question, another interesting thing that I was wondering is, and this would maybe some people listening would be able to relate to this and maybe send in their views on this or what it's like at their workplace, how their colleagues treat them. But we're just wondering how well do your colleagues understand and support you as an individual on the autism spectrum? Do you find that mostly they're understanding of you, or you do come across some people that maybe don't necessarily understand autism?
I would say the majority of people accept me in the workplace, including my, you know, I like to call sometimes eccentric things that I do, or idiosyncrasies. Some people have come right out and say things to me like, oh, it's all in your head. When are you just going to get over this and get on with it? Those people, I find it very hard to try and educate them, because they don't see something physically wrong, so they assume that because they can't see anything,
right,
that there is nothing there, that's all a made-up thing. So those people I kind of just try and just kind of stay away from. If I try to educate them, it doesn't really seem like it really wants to work, so I just avoid those people. But it can be, as the only person on the autism spectrum in my workplace, that can be trying at times. I often wish I worked that I would have had great computer skills or something, where I'm working in an environment where the majority of people are on the autism spectrum, because it would be a lot easier. I'm a fighter, I don't give up, and if I get knocked down flat out, I get right back up and go right back in the fight. So that's how I've learned to be as the only person on the spectrum in my work environment.
That's definitely a very powerful message, Anita, and I know that many people and families listening to that will give them hope, because of course the awareness and spreading the message to people, you know, that don't know what autism is really important. But of course, we live in a world where, you know, there still are inequalities, and we can't get everybody to understand it. And like you said, that's something that we have to kind of take on the head and, you know, get back up and go again for those of us that are trying to spread the message out there, really. So I think that's really, really great. And yeah, I suppose a brave thing to do as well, because maybe if you had this might not necessarily be right and you may not agree, but I'm just thinking, maybe if there were other co-workers that were on the spectrum that you worked with, you know, the other colleagues wouldn't necessarily be able to make such statements and say, well, you know, because they would be supporting what you say. But maybe it seems as if, because there's only yourself there on the spectrum, they're kind of maybe not so much teaming up on you, but, you know, they maybe just think, oh, you know, as Anita's the only person, there's nobody else that will say, well, actually, you know, you're wrong, because, you know, this person is also on the spectrum and they have the same problems. So it almost seems as if, you know, I'm not sure how you feel about that, if there was a co-worker that joined that was on the spectrum, if that would help, or, you know, you'd certainly have other opinions to the co-workers, and they wouldn't be just taking aboard the opinions you have, but they would also have the other co-worker that would be on the spectrum.
Right, well, here's something I found interesting. Apparently, there's a movie, I haven't seen the movie, but there's a movie out called The Accountant with Ben Affleck, and apparently, from what I have read, the reviews about it, he did an outstanding job portraying somebody with Asperger's syndrome, and a coworker about a week ago, one morning, came up to me, and this guy, he says, wow, you're my hero, and I look at him, and I said, what are you talking about? And he said, yesterday I saw the movie The Accountant, and I didn't know that that's what you go through and what you experience life at. And he says, you're my hero now that you can work in this workplace and have that.
Wow.
So I looked at him pretty shocked, and I said, well, I appreciate that. And I wish that other people would see movies like The Accountant if it's really as good as the reviews that I read. So that's the kind of thing that helps the general public see and understand what autistic people go through. Someone's just like, they don't want to believe me if I try to explain to them. They think I'm exaggerating. They think I'm joking or lying or whatever it is they think. But when they see it from some other source, then all of a sudden they're like, oh, I didn't realize, wow, that's like, that must be really awful to experience life like that or something. And then they have a better perspective and give you a little more respect and everything. So I'm glad that movie came out for whoever does see it, who doesn't know anything about autism. Hopefully it will help them get very enlightened about it.
Yes, definitely. I think that's really important in the media, portraying that's awareness as well, and something that's disseminated, probably across the world, that's going to change people's views is really important. And I suppose it kind of gives hope as well, doesn't it, that people are embracing it and trying to make the world more equal and to actually educate and teach people about autism so that they can be more understanding is something that is very important to have. Especially when it comes to the workplace and people on the spectrum having to deal with other people that just don't understand them or just have the ignorance and don't even want to start to, understand what they go through, not even to research or speak to organisations or other people about it. So, yeah, that's definitely very important. Sarah, I'm going to hand over to you now because I know that you have some questions for Anita.
Do you feel that you are able to relate to and better understand patients you anaesthetise who are going through the anxieties of being put to sleep, particularly if they are on the autistic spectrum? And are there any particular methods of taking autistic patients through a desensitising process, telling them what to expect before putting them to sleep?
Yes, I can certainly better relate to patients, especially autistic patients. The main thing that I do is and here's something that I've been working on, is educating my coworkers on how to interact with the autistic patients and special things that they can do all throughout the whole perioperative phase of what they can do to make it a much better positive experience for the autistic patient, and which actually just falls over into any patient to make it a much more pleasant experience, but in particular for the autistic patient. And that would entail things like when the autistic patients arrive to the preoperative area, put that patient in a much more quiet area where there's the least amount of traffic. When I say traffic, I mean people walking by, and noise and phones ringing and things like that. Put them in a quiet area. Limit the number of staff that deals with that patient. Don't have one nurse after another for like 10 different people to go in to interact with that patient. All it's going to do is make them more anxious and scared and everything by not having a consistent one nurse or one staff member coming in to interact with them. Keep the lights dimly lit. Don't have on bright, blinding overhead lights. Typically in those kind of rooms, there is several lights to put on. Don't put them all on. Just put on the one that has enough light, obviously, to be able to see the patient and see everything properly, but not blinding in their face. Don't have any music playing in that area to add to the sensory overload. Talk to the patient as if that they're going to understand you. Oftentimes, and this is a strange phenomenon, when the nurses or staff will come out and they'll roll their eyes and say, oh God, that patient in there is autistic, and they kind of make a face as I'm looking at them like, well, thank you, because I'm autistic too, when they say things like that. But talk to the patient as if they understand you. Don't, like, talk to the parent or whoever is the caregiver sitting there. Make the autistic individual part of the whole process. Talk slow. Talk with the least amount of words. And what I say is neurotypical people often tend to just kind of talk on and on and on, just to make small talk, and they think that that will actually help lessen the autistic person's anxiety, when in fact it's probably going to make it worse, because they're going to get overloaded by too much conversation going on that isn't necessary. I also tell them, don't touch the autistic individual unless it's absolutely necessary for things like taking their blood pressure or doing something of a medical nature of that sort. Talk to them ahead of time what you're going to do. If, for example, you are going to put the blood pressure cuff on, you tell them what you're going to say. I'm going to put the blood pressure cuff on your arm. And if the person, say if it's a younger person or an autistic person who might be nonverbal or something, you might, the staff person might need to put that blood pressure cuff on the adult person who's with them, their caregiver, the parent, whoever it is, to show the autistic person what's going to happen, so they can see what it is that's going to be done to them, so it is no surprise when it is done to them. When a patient is getting wheeled down the hall to the operating room, for example, alert people ahead of time on the path where you have to push the stretcher. There shouldn't be excessive talking and laughing in hallways and all kind of things. And once you get the person in the operating room, there again, don't be touching the patient excessively, except when only necessary, until they're asleep. Have the room temperature at a comfortable temperature, not too hot, not too cold. Overhead lights turned off, just ambient lights in the room, and things like that to minimize sensory overload.
Because I'm a needle phobic, and I've been a needle phobic for quite a long time. And when I go to see my GP, my local doctor surgery, I always panic when he goes, let's take a blood sample, because I have problems with my monthly cycle. And when he mentions a blood test, that's it, I panic, and I go into full mode, and I think, oh, I don't want to stay in there because, you know, I just don't like being touched.
Right.
And so they never explain, you know, they never sort of like say, well, this is going to happen, you know, procedure. And they just sort of like, they're in there. Do you know what I mean? They don't explain to me why they're taking it, what it's for, because again, when I go for my yearly medical checkup, they always take a blood test, but they never tell me what it's for.
Yes, unfortunately, that's a majority of medical people are like that. I always tell people what I'm going to do before I do it, and ask them if they have any questions before I do it. And then, of course, if you have to take blood from somebody or things like that, there are ways, things that you can do to kind of minimize the nasty pinch of the needle. I personally dread to have to get blood work done myself because I know last time I had blood work done, just for general once a year blood work, and I was very dehydrated because it was the end of the day after a long day at work. I was massively dehydrated, so all my veins were kind of clamped down, and they had to stick me multiple times. So about the fourth needle stick, I was not very happy, to say the least. And you know, I probably, my tone of voice was probably not quite so happy when I made some comment about having to get sticked four times. And Yes, again, they don't say anything. They just keep sticking and sticking and sticking and not saying a word. And I prefer if somebody was like how I treat patients, where they talk to you ahead of time, tell you what's going to happen, and all of that. It helps. It just helps lessen the person's stress and anxiety. And like I said, there are things you can do to numb up the skin with some numbing medicine before they put the larger needle in to get the blood and things like that. Unfortunately, but you see in the book that I have coming out in September, it has all of these things very, very explicitly explained in that book of what people can do, healthcare people, to make all of these experiences far more positive for autistic individuals.
I'd love a copy of your book, Anita, because I think it would be a good one to show to NHS professionals, because, you know, they're not in your shoes, they're not in your situation, they're not in your predicament, if you know what I mean. And, you know, no matter how hard I've tried to work with NHS professionals, all they ever want to do is about them. They don't see how important it is to engage with autistic individuals. All they ever think about is me. How we want things to be done, how we want things to run. It's never about, you know, saying to these people, look, you know, we should be engaged with them, but they don't.
Exactly.
And so I think, you know, it struggles for me, because in the past, yes, I self-harmed, and they don't understand myself being on the autistic spectrum. They don't understand what I'm going through, and mental health keeps saying that autism isn't classed as a mental health issue. So, therefore, they will not support autistic individuals, because they said, unless the government proves that we've got to support an autistic individual, we won't do it.
Wow, I didn't realize that. That's very horrible.
And so I had a breakdown with mental health in 2006, because they kept saying, we'll bring you back into mental health because you're self-harming, you're self-destructing, stick her on medication for the rest of her life, she'll go away happy. But it doesn't solve the problem. So in the end, I had some NHS colleagues that gave me a project, which I'm now running with a brand new NHS colleague here in the UK who works for the Community Team Learning Disability, and he's absolutely brilliant support to me and helping me run the project. And he said, if it hadn't have been for Clive giving you this project, you know, where would you have been?
Wow.
I didn't want to be sectioned. I mean, yes, I did self-harm. I'm not trying to deny it, but they didn't help me. And for me, it was a cry of help. It was a cry of somebody listen, but they didn't. So what was I supposed to do?
Right, right. But to see, this kind of thing makes me so angry when I hear how other people, like they try to marginalize, I don't know if that's the right word I'm looking for, autistic people. Is very, very frustrating. You know, we've come a long way on one hand in some areas of the world and stuff, but we have a long, long, long way to go before we're ever at the point of being treated as equal, as like other people and everything. Just because we're different and we don't fit into their little cookie mold of what they think, what other people think is quote normal. It just is so frustrating. Frustrating to me when I hear things like that.
And, you know, they just go, oh, well, give Sarah medication, she'll be fine. But they don't understand the full picture. They don't understand the meltdowns and the emotional episodes and the depressive mood swings that can occur sometimes. And I just feel so isolated on my own when that happens. And I just go, oh, well, what do you want us to do?
Yes, no, that is a rather big issue, Sarah, and I think even looking at actually creating initiatives and programs that help people with autism, and also looking at alternative therapies. Last year I organised I organised an event with Dr. Becky McKenzie at Plymouth University, which was a 2-day conference on autism and alternative therapies, looking at utilising the arts to help individuals, you know, like autism movement therapy that Joanne does, dance. Now, okay, it's not one fits all. It has to be, you know, it depends on the individual. But there's so many different art forms of therapy that will help people rather than just saying, oh, you know, take this medication, goodbye. That is, you know, that's terrible. Is that really the way to treat someone? No, you know, it's awful. There's things we can do, work with people, help people, support people. You know, it's really important to do that, not just to say to them, you know, take this medication, it will calm you down, off you go.
Right.
It's just, no, it's wrong. So I completely agree with you, and it's terrible to hear that, Sarah, as well.
Because we have tried to challenge them. We have tried to sit down with them, with some colleagues at Navigo, and say, look, you know, well, how are you going to improve the quality of life for these people then? And all their reply is, well, we're doing a big piece of work with the CCD. We're doing this. But at the end of the day, it's not convincing me that they will change.
Mm.
It's not convincing me. And unless they have money behind it to fund this new little adventure, they just don't convince me they'll ever change. I'm sorry, it won't convince me.
No, and I won't mention the name, Sarah, and I'm not sure if Anita's heard of it, but there was a programme I hear on last week in the UK on television, and it's a new documentary about an autism unit with children and young adults, where it's kind of like a secure unit, and one of the issues that's been highlighted, which I would call inhumane, is medicating these children to the point of, well, you know, practically unconsciousness, so that they're not really aware of things. Sarah, did you say that one of the things highlighted was that, because I haven't actually watched the whole program, they were sedating people, or
it was called
I wouldn't name it, just in case, Sarah,
but it was a documentary, and they were saying that they were using forceful restraint of adults with autism, and they were restraining them and sedating them with medication by giving it to them by injections, just to shut them up.
Mm.
And one or two clients died within that facility, but it was quite appalling. And one girl that was in there, her family had to fight to get her out of the institution because they were just treating her like a lab monkey. And again, they were using restraint, they were using putting her in a cell with no light, no engagement or no support, and the family had to fight to get her out there. And when they did, they found her this most amazing supportive care place that was so appropriate for her, and it changed her whole life around. And I'm thinking, we shouldn't have these institutions here anymore. They shouldn't be allowed to even exist, never allowed.
This is something that we almost relate to, kind of like notions of old times, you know, when people with disabilities were really, really segregated. I mean, we're not in an equal world right now, but it's far better than it was 100 years ago. So yeah, it is very concerning, Sarah. So having these initiatives and advocacy that both you and Anita do is really, really important, to share your stories and empower people. So thank you, Sarah.
You know, so listening to all this, it reminds me, recently a co-worker who's they're from Vietnam, and they said to me, he heard me talking about doing some kind of autism advocacy work of some sort, and he kind of laughed and said to me, he said, in my country, people with your problem get put in institutions and they lock you up and throw the key away, and he started laughing. Which I didn't find it very funny. I didn't find it funny that he said that to me like that, but I did not find it funny that if that's really what they do in that country, that's beyond horrific, that's how people with autism or any kind of thing would get treated in put away in an institution for a lot. Unfortunately, I know things like that do exist, and like we talked about, that's really it's very heartbreaking, saddening that other people would have so much control over another human being's life to do that to somebody.
It's quite sad because you think, you know, if you are an agency that are not trained upon autism and you are not qualified, then what are you doing in the job?
Right.
Yeah, no, I think, no, that's a big issue. And I think, Sarah, that actually is quite nicely into question six, the next question that you've got for Anita.
Yeah. What advice would you give to parents or individuals who are on the autistic spectrum regarding employment and coping with social interactions?
Well, when I talked earlier about the best advice that I can give to parents is get your kid going on some kind of jobs at a very early age. That's what's going to build those building blocks for their success later on as an adult. You cannot keep them home like a prisoner and just keep them there, at home with the family and think that they're going to be ready to take on the world somehow miraculously when they're 25 or something, because it doesn't work like that. Even if you had a child who wasn't autistic, a parent needs to get that kid going out in the world and doing things, but much more so when they're autistic. And you can't, yes, safety is the number one issue to always keep in mind, never have the child do anything that's not safe or anything. But even if the parent has to be there or supervise it and do whatever, but get that kid doing some kind of odd jobs, little jobs, helping neighbors, cutting grass, doing house chores at a very early age. Because if they don't, I mean, Temple Grandin is an example. I'm certainly an example of how it prepares you for success as an adult. There's just no way around it, absolutely none, unfortunately. So that's the best advice I can give is for that, for success regarding employment and social interactions. I mean, the more you socially interact with people, the better you're going to get at it. When I talk to people, now I can look people in the eye, I can have conversations with them. I might not make the most facial expressions or anything, and people might not be able to read my facial expressions because I might not be making any facial expression, but inside I'm certainly feeling the emotions and everything. They just don't come out on my face, but I can express it verbally, and then they'll understand what I'm talking about. But again, that's only because I've done it so many times, over a million times of interacting with people. That's the only way you can get better at it, is do it over and over again.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for that. So going on to another topic that we have, I think we've covered lots about employment, which is great. But we wanted to talk to you because I think when we last spoke to you, Anita, it was, I think, just before your wedding. So that's really something, a huge, huge, wonderful event that's happened since we were last on air with you. We'd love to hear a bit about the autism, the first all autism wedding that you had with your husband, and also the fact that it was open to the public. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the message and the reason behind it being public in relation to autism for people to experience, and the message that you were attaching to that about the fact that people with autism can find love still.
Right. Well, the reason we decided to have our wedding at an autism conference as part of the conference and then open it up to the public is to make the public awareness about that autistic people have the same need for love and relationships and possibly marriage if they're interested in that, just like anyone else. I know oftentimes public people are shocked to find out that autistic people have emotions and have needs and desires just like everyone else, because of the fact that we don't necessarily show it on our exterior, but on our interior, we certainly are having those feelings and needs and desires just like other people do. And I wanted to make that public for that very reason. And our wedding actually did reach international media attention. We were in People twice. They had us on Good Morning America. They put a video segment on there from the wedding, and they asked us questions on the phone, and many newspapers across the country and everything, which I thought was a great thing to help with that public awareness. Every little bit helps.
That's incredible. Yeah, definitely.
You know, whether we get it out there, anybody get the message out there to the rest of the world to see that autistic people are like other people with their feelings and emotions and everything, and we need to want to be heard, and we want to be loved and respected and accepted. And I think, you know, one of the big things, Abraham and I, we talk about with each other, why our relationship is so successful. Well, our ability to communicate with each other is the biggest factor that we have, that is the main building blocks for everything else. But that we accept each other, you know, here's two individuals who both of us said we had separate lives prior to us meeting. Neither one of us had any friends. We never felt accepted or respected or anything. And then we find each other. So we feel like the luckiest people on earth that we have each other, because now we have that respect and acceptance that we never had. And so we treasure it tremendously. And that's a very, very big thing that, that we have.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I saw lots of the pictures and the videos. And I know you also sent me a YouTube link, so I know if people would like to find out more about it, there's links that people can visit and actually watch and see pictures from the special day that you had and the messages that, you know, you string to that as well. Advice for people. That's wonderful. And I was reading, actually, it's just, and of course it must be just over a year, you were celebrating your anniversary, so that's wonderful as well. And of course, I'm sure that it's been a great year for you as well, hopefully. I'm sure it has. And I'm sure in that time also from the wedding that you've also received lots of questions and attention from that as well. So I guess there's places people can contact you and leave comments on the videos that you posted from the day itself as well.
Yes, people are always welcome to send me emails, which I often get many from parents, from individuals on the spectrum, from educators, all kind of various people send questions, which I do always answer individually.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. That's wonderful. And I'm really pleased that it's received so much attention, because in itself it's created such a huge message, an awareness message, and I'm glad that you know, various media sources picked that up and spreaded the message as well, because that's what gets people talking and educated as well. So it was wonderful. Sarah, I think the next question's for you.
Yeah, the last question we wanted to ask you is, we are aware that at the end of the month, you'll be going over to New York to talk at the United Nations event. Please, could you tell us what you will be talking about and how this came about?
Yes, that's very, very interesting.
Yes, I was very excited. About 2 months ago, I received an invitation from the United Nations inviting me to speak at the event. What it is, it's going to be three different panels discussing various topics. The panel that I'm on is going to be moderated by Karen Zucker, who is the co-author of the book In a Different Key, The History of Autism, she wrote with John Donvan. He's also going to be a panel moderator, a different panel than I'm on, but So the panel that I'm going to be on is going to be talking about dating, relationships, love, and marriage. And so I'm pretty excited about that. From what I understand, it's live stream around the world and translated into...
Oh, brilliant. That was my next question.
...languages. So I'm very excited. And also they recorded and archive it so it can be retrieved by anyone at any time from then on. So I am very, very, very honored, excited, and everything to share my experiences and to meet other people and hear their experiences. And it just thrills me to see all the different people. When I look at the program, all the different people that are going to be from all over the world who are not autistic themselves, but working diligently to improve the lives of those with autism, it just makes me absolutely tickled to see how many people are working so hard on such a high scale to do that. I'm very, very thankful to those people who do that, and I'm very honored to be part of this whole event at the United Nations.
That's incredible. And I know that you'll also be meeting one of our other colleagues that has a radio show with us, Jadira Calderon from Florida. And she has a daughter that's on the autism spectrum as well. I know she's very much looking forward to attending the event. And I think also she plans to publish a book for which is called Autism in the Happy Kingdom, which is relating to, I think, particularly directed towards parents and children on the spectrum.
Right.
So I think the collaboration, the message is that the collaboration between individuals and organisations is imperative. You know, it's really important because everybody has different knowledge and skills. Of course, we're in different places of the world. So I think the key message is for people to work together, and that creates the education and awareness.
Yes,
sorry, Anita. I was just saying, I don't know if you've been reading on Facebook just recently, but DPAC, a charity organisation, they're involved with the United Nations, and they were talking about how they wanted to challenge the government around the violation of those on the autistic spectrum and other disabilities, and they were saying that there's a very big stink about it because they feel the government are violating the needs of all those, not just with autism, but with other disabilities. And I think, you know, I fully support this, that why shouldn't we challenge the government? Because unless the government are in the shoes of somebody with not just autism and Asperger's and other serious disabilities, you know, they have no idea what we're going through.
Yes, yeah, no, exactly. They don't unless they walk in our shoes.
Yeah, I think, Sarah, that completely links back to the whole thing about people needing just the overall message of education and awareness, that it's such an important thing. And the existence of organisations and advocates like yourself and Anita are so important, because without any of this, you know, I really don't know where the world would be. And I think you'd probably agree, Anita, that probably, you know, the organisations probably far outweigh the work that the government does towards autism. So I think if we weren't to have the wonderful organisations that we have, we wouldn't be in such a great place that we are now. Of course, there still needs to be work, but the existence of organisations play such a huge role in driving forward the change and the acceptance and the education.
Yeah, because obviously they're doing a fantastic job, and you know, it's hard. The government keeps saying, "Oh, well, we are engaging with those with autism, and no, this and that," but they're not. So how can you say you're engaging with them when you're not?
Right.
And you need to be, because unless you do, you're just going round and round in the vicious circle and saying, no, well, we are doing this and we are doing this and we are doing this, but they're not. And yeah, this is an argument we keep putting across. They're not engaging with us. They're just making people commit suicide for the sake of it. They're not realising the damage they're doing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, no, so that's, you know, it really exemplifies that people doing this kind of work, advocacy, is such a massive, important thing. And I think, yeah, it's underestimated. This area of work isn't appreciated by everyone. And it's really great that I think in the last kind of 10, 20 years, it's been more accepted. But like Anita was saying, we are still hoping to move forwards, and we're still trying to gain people's understanding. And there is only to a certain degree that you can engage people, because if they don't want to know or they want to snub it, there's nothing we can do. We can only keep doing what we're doing and be grateful for those that are being on side with the organisations that are trying to make difference. And in turn, the main thing I think is actually helping those individuals on the spectrum with things like employment and just generally day-to-day life, the skills they need to be able to live and live in a world where they're accepted and given equal opportunities.
Because, you know, I mean, even though I'm autistic, you know, doing the project that I do with my colleague at the Community Learning Disability Team, he's absolutely brilliant with me, as I said before. But, you know, he said, if you hadn't have had this project, you would have just have been stuck in limbo. You'd have continued self-harming. You'd have continued going into utter destruction. But he said, since you've had this project, he said, it's just been so successful, this project. And I think eventually we're hoping to set up our own advocacy service for those on the autistic spectrum like me that have been failed by the system. So I'm quite excited that, you know, I'm challenging, you know, challenging the project and fighting for the
dreams where we want to go. Yeah, I think it's been really empowering for you, Sarah, so I think that's really wonderful and a lovely story that it's helped you so much. And I know that you do some wonderful work with the radio shows as well, as you are the key member that oversees all the radio shows now, and it's great that we've got, you know, hosts that do shows nearly every other day now, and some weeks every day, so it's wonderful to have global access to people with different perspectives. So it's been great, and I've really enjoyed the show today, this evening, this afternoon, over in Pensacola, where Anita is, and we're really grateful for Anita joining us today, sparing the time to come on the show. And I think time's gone very fast with the year anniversary, which you celebrated already, and we're very pleased for you. And just say, keep up, the message I would have is keep up the great work, and you know, you're a huge inspiration, both you and Abraham, and it's been lovely to talk to you, and we always enjoy following you and having you be involved with Positively Autistic as well. And I think, yeah, a huge thank you to you, Anita, and maybe we could finish off with, maybe I can leave some of the links to your social media and your website, Anita, and I don't know if you'd like to read some of them off a final time for everybody as well, for listeners, parents, or individuals on the spectrum, if they would like to reach out to you if they have any further questions.
Yes, first of all, Joe, I'd like to say, for you and Sarah, I enjoyed very much talking to both of you. It was a very enjoyable afternoon here, and I'd like to join you folks whenever. Maybe also I can share when I come back from the United Nations.
Yes, that would be lovely.
Share how that experience went. And people can log on to my our website called Global Autism Consulting Organization.org, which is globalaco.org. I'll send that to you so you can put it on your thing. Or AnitaLesko.com is also another way. Either one of those, people can reach me. We're on the contact page. If they click there, it'll take them to an email to me, and I'd be happy to answer anyone's questions. Personally, I will, like I said, I answer everything that I get.
That's excellent, and a very big inspiration that you are to us all, Anita. So thank you very much for joining us today. And we will definitely look forward to and definitely reconvene with you, if not before, the United Nations event, and love to hear about what happens there. So thank you so much,
Joe and Sarah. It was very enjoyable.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We thank you to all of our listeners today on Positively Autistic, Sarah's Autism Chat. And we'll be returning at the normal time of Tuesdays at 7 p.m. UK time, which I believe at the moment will be 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and 2 p.m. Central Standard Time. And 12 noon Pacific Standard Time at the moment, seeing as our clocks haven't gone forward here yet. So thank you all for listening, and we will speak to you soon.